On Monday, Joe Biden made his first major announcement as president-elect.
I've named the COVID-19 Transition Advisory Board, comprised of distinguished public health experts, to help our transition team translate the Biden-Harris COVID-19 plan into action.
Well, throughout the course of this pandemic, we've talked to many distinguished public health experts, too. So, from NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point, and today, we're convening a meeting of our own informal COVID-19 advisory board. Call it the On Point Coronavirus Task Force. We want to hear what they'd advise the folks who have President-elect Biden's ear. So imagine a table, a task force table, and I welcome to the table Angela Rasmussen, associate research scientist at the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. Angie Rasmussen, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on our informal task force today. Also with us is Ali Khan, former director of the CDC's Office of Public Health Preparedness and Response. He's currently dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. Dr. Khan, welcome back to you.
Thank you. Glad to be back on again for the 320th day of the outbreak.
That is indeed a sad count, but we need to be aware of it. And Michael Mina is also with us. He's assistant professor of epidemiology, immunology, and infectious diseases at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Dr. Mina, welcome back to you.
Thanks so much, Meghna.
Okay, so task force, day one priorities for the Biden administration. What should they be? I'm going to get a quick answer from all three of you, and then please just dive in and hash it out. Angie Rasmussen, let's start with you. Day one priorities.
Well, day one that Biden takes office, I think probably the first priority is going to be things that he can accomplish immediately. So instating a nationwide mask mandate. But, you know, I think even before that, the first priority really needs to be establishing a good communication or line of communication with the public. I think that one of the reasons why the pandemic has gone off the rails the way that it has is there has been a lot of mixed messaging, and there's really been an information vacuum in which this misinformation and conspiracy theories have really thrived. I think that on day one now, they need to really put together a clear and consistent, unambiguous message to the public about what they plan to do and what the public should be doing to support those efforts.
Okay. So communication, we'll definitely come back to that. Dr. Khan, your top priorities.
Actually, before I get to my top priorities, I think we should remember at 1,400 deaths a day, there's going to be 50 to 100,000 people who are not going to live by the time of the inauguration. So my first set of advice would actually be to the current president to either step up with the science or step out of the way for the science and CDC. But if in 50,000 to 100,000 deaths from now, we're still on this death spiral, I'd have three messages for the president. And message number one is around strategy and partnership. Public health is a local responsibility, and we need to adopt a containment strategy in conjunction with the governors and the partnership and with the state local health officials. Number two, I agree with Angie, is around communication. How do we communicate a strategy of hope and horizon that's about getting rid of cases as opposed to the endless spiral we're on now? And then number three is obviously execution. How do we execute against that strategy?
Okay. And Michael Mina, your top priorities.
Well, I think I guess we're all on similar footings right now. I think that the absolute first thing starting today is to just start building trust. If we don't start building trust with the American public, and the Biden administration doesn't with everyone, you know, this is a pandemic and a virus that doesn't care about politics and doesn't care about borders. And so really getting everyone on board to recognize just the immense challenge ahead of us and that we all have to play a part. More pragmatically, I think we've seen a fairly lackadaisical, to say it lightly, approach to this virus so far by the current administration. And you know, shifting mindset and shifting gears to start pouring the resources into this fight that it really deserves and mandates at this point, treating it like a war, frankly, and figuring out what resources would normally go into a war that would otherwise be killing hundreds of thousands of Americans and taking that mindset and place it into all the science and all of the activities that we're going to have to do as a nation to battle it back.
Okay, so let's do this now, task force. Let's talk about the one priority that the three of you are in lockstep on, and that is communication. So if you were talking to the president-elect, President-elect Biden right now, what would you advise him to do? What would you advise him to say? How often should he say it? How does he build that trust with the American public? And again, Angie, I'm going to start with you, but Dr. Khan and Mina, please just kind of jump in. I want to hear the three of you talk through this together, but Angie, I'll give you the first crack at it.
Yeah, so I think this is going to be something that is going to take quite a bit of time. I think that, you know, what the current administration has done has really eroded the trust in public health agencies and public health authority, and lost the engagement of the public. And I really strongly believe that you can't have public health without the public actively participating in it. So the first thing I think that President-elect Biden is going to have to do is reach out directly to the American people and tell them exactly what the situation is right now. There needs to be complete and total transparency about the, frankly, really bad situation that we are in right now, the trajectory that we are on, and give clear guidance, science-based, evidence-based guidance on how we can contain that and mitigate the effect that this upward case trajectory is on.
Can I just jump in here for a second?
Yeah.
And again, I'm sorry, I keep saying I want the three of you to talk through it, but I've got questions. So but specifically, and not to be sort of obtuse about this, what does it mean that communication with the public? Like, should President-elect Biden go on TV every night at 6 o'clock every single day and stand there and talk directly to the American people? I mean, what level of direct communication are we talking about?
I think that would be helpful. I don't know that that's going to happen, but President-elect Biden and his surrogates need to be getting out the same basic message that many people in public health have been saying since day one. That is ways to protect yourself from becoming infected, the critical importance of getting community transmission down, the importance of participating in testing and tracing and isolating infected people, quarantining their contacts, this basic epidemiology that we know works to contain and control epidemics and pandemics. I think that to the American people, that's the advice that people need to be hearing over and over, because much of that guidance has been undermined. And I think in tandem with that, the Biden team needs to be reaching out to governors, state and local health officials, and really establishing a collaborative working relationship. Because as Ali pointed out, public health does happen on a local level, and we need to have everybody on board, not just other Democrats or people within the Biden sphere. We really need to establish those working relationships so that they can reiterate the same message to the people.
Mm.
So Magna, there's a couple of components to this communication, right? So I think first it's about communicating hope and horizon to the American people, reminding them that countries like China, Australia, most recently, Vietnam, Thailand, Singapore, I can go on and on, have zero cases and zero deaths today. So we have the tools available to us today if we wanted zero cases in America. And I think it's very good to remind Americans of that. And even across America, certain states have made the important public health decisions to get cases down, whereas other cases have not. And I'm very, very sure that Americans in New Hampshire and Maine look genetically just like Americans in Nebraska and Iowa and North Dakota. And I'm very sure the virus is the exact same virus hanging out in New England that's hanging out in the Midwest. So if it's not the virus and it's not our genetics, then it's basically policy and the choices that we're making. So remind people of that and then communicate. So I love the communication part, needless to say, but I think the communication part starts with what is the strategy? How are you going to do the control triad, which is we know the control triad is what gets rid of disease within these countries that have been very successful. And the control triad starts with evidence-based, data-driven, metric-driven leadership at all levels, local, state, and national, couple that with decreasing community transmission. That's about test, trace, isolate, and quarantine. And finally, component number three is community engagement around masking, social distancing, and hand washing. The control triad has worked everywhere anybody has decided to use it.
Michael Mina, go ahead.
Yeah, I think speaking to the, I think getting governors on board is exceedingly important right now. Biden isn't faced with a challenge of getting the people who voted for him on board with this. In general, this virus, unfortunately, I said that it doesn't care about politics, but politics seems to care about the virus. And the people and the communities across the country that might be hardest to really get on board to understand sort of what steps we have to take are going to be likely not the people who largely voted for him. And so one of the challenges or one of the avenues that he has is to use the sort of much more narrow scope of people that he could work with, which are governors and people across all of the states, to really speak to their constituents first. Use them to get a science-based approach into their thinking. And then I think Biden can really start speaking to the whole population. But I do worry that if he starts, you know, right off the bat, assuming everyone is listening to him about this virus, there's going to be a lot of people who do not. And the strategy, I think the strategy and science go hand in hand with this. I've said it a million times that we need strategy for this virus. We have to treat it like a war, and we would never just flagrantly sort of throw soldiers abroad or something with and throw guns somewhere else and soldiers over here and tanks over there and say, hopefully it all works out. We would be very, very strategic in every step of the process, and we need to start doing that.
Well, guess what? Right after this break, we're going to talk with a former governor about how you get governors in 50 states across this country on board to really beat this pandemic. Today, we are convening our own informal COVID-19 task force with some of the top minds in public health. Angie Rasmussen joins us. Ali Khan is with us as well. And so is Michael Mina. We will have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we are convening our own informal COVID-19 task force. It's a group of top thinkers in public health that we've spoken to over the course of this pandemic. We've brought them back today to sit around a task force table with us to hear how they would advise the actual task force that President-elect Biden announced would be advising him on Monday. I'm joined today by Angie Rasmussen. She's Associate Research Scientist at the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Ali Khan is with us. He's Dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Nebraska, formerly Director of the CDC's Office of Public Health Preparedness and Response. Michael Mina is also with us. He is an assistant professor of epidemiology, immunology, and infectious diseases at Harvard University. Now, before the break, our task force talked about the primary importance of communication to the American public, that this has to be a top priority of the Biden administration. They also talked about the key importance of partnering with governors. Now, on Monday, President-elect Joe Biden met with his new COVID-19 advisory board, and he talked about stressing the importance of local officials.
We'll follow the science. We'll follow the science. Let me say that again. And we'll adjust to new data when it comes in. And we'll listen and work in cooperation with governors and local leaders of both parties who are fighting this virus in their communities this very day. There is so much good work happening
at state and local levels across the country, governors, mayors. They're stepping up. The advisory board will listen and learn lessons from their experience.
President-elect Joe Biden on Monday. Now let's hear a little bit from what one of those governors has been saying. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem appeared back-to-back on ABC's This Week on Sunday with host George Stephanopoulos. And Cuomo suggested that some Republican governors might take this pandemic more seriously, or should, now that President Trump has not won a second term. And Governor Noem had to say this in response when she was asked about the rising cases in South Dakota.
Well, it is a regional increase that we're seeing. We are testing more. And frankly, George, I'm not going to take advice from Governor Cuomo. He has the second worst death rate per 100,000 people in this nation. He's at 173 deaths per 100,000 per capita. South Dakota's at 54. I appreciated that President Trump gave us the flexibility to do the right thing in our state, and we'll continue to do that. He let me do my job.
That's Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota there. Now, she was comparing death per capita death rates across the entire duration of this pandemic thus far. But the trajectory of cases in places like South Dakota is going nowhere good. 70 South Dakotans per 100,000 are now in the hospital. That's 26% up since last week. Across South Dakota, there's a 54% positivity rate for new COVID cases there. So joining us now is Kathleen Sebelius. She served as Secretary of Health and Human Services from 2009 to 2014 in the Obama administration, was also governor of Kansas from 2003 to 2009, and she joins us from Lawrence, Kansas. Secretary Sebelius, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Magna. Nice to be with you in this illustrious panel.
Indeed. So how do you get governors who may not be politically sympathetic to the president-elect on board?
Well, I personally think governors will be thrilled to be on board. And regardless of what you just heard from Governor Noem, they're still under, I would say, a tyranny from the top, where President Trump has made it very clear throughout this pandemic that if governors deviate from his message, they may not get the help they need. If they are not nice to him, he may not return a call. That's a terrifying place to be as a governor in the middle of a pandemic. We have never seen the federal government walk away from a national crisis, and that's exactly what this administration did. So I think that President-elect Biden has made it very clear there will be a clear, transparent national plan. Governors will be able to know then how their response can coordinate with that national plan, what their responsibility is, and they can mobilize at the state and local level the resources to do that. At this point, they've really been told since March they're on their own. Go find your own protective equipment. And governors scramble to try and do that, often competing against one another and competing against the federal government. Go figure out your own guidance, since once CDC put out guidance, the president immediately contradicted that guidance. Go do your own thing. We will not help you. We will actually not even make the stockpile available to you. So we've never seen anything like this, where the federal government just walked away. I think it was referred to by Michael as a lackadaisical approach. I would call it a very dangerous non-approach, where the federal government took no responsibility except to try and drive toward a vaccine. That's very good news, but it shows you the kind of energy that the United States can muscle. They can move things, they have resources and logistics and opportunities to really mobilize a national presence. And I think governors, whether or not they can say out loud this message before Donald Trump is actually out of the White House, I think they will welcome a traditional response where the local officials do what they can, they call on the state for help, and then the state looks to the federal government for help and support that they can't possibly mobilize within the borders of their state.
Okay, so it makes a lot of sense to me, Kathleen Sebelius, that if the federal government comes to a governor and says, here's the resources we're going to give you, here's the money that we're going to give you, here's the sort of expertise support we're going to give you, that governors would accept that. It makes a lot of sense, because who's going to say no to that? But what we've also heard from our task force today, as we've been hearing over the past many months, is that in addition, one of the key parts of a successive pandemic solution is behavior change as well. So, but and that requires, again, that sort of communication and leadership coming from governors talking to the people in their state. Do you see that happening?
Well, I think I would disagree with one point that either a panel member made, or Meghna, you may have asked this question about, should President-elect Biden be talking every day to the American public? I would say that hopefully President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris will kind of get out of the way and let the scientists talk every day to the public. Mm-hmm. One of the issues is that this public health crisis has been politicized, and the sciences have either been muzzled, or the CDC has been contradicted, or immediately you got mixed messages, and it was made a political wedge issue. So I think the less Vice President Biden makes it about himself and Democrats, and the more he reinforces science. I think it's very important that he make it clear that he will follow the science. He said that all along. But let the scientists talk. You know, if Tony Fauci and an official from the CDC do daily briefings, very clear, very consistent, and then they are echoed by the political leaders, I think that will immediately start to set a very different tone.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm going to just jump in here. Sorry, Secretary Stavulis, I'm going to jump in here because that was the question that did indeed come from me. And I do look forward to a day where scientists are front and center and are allowed to speak. And we don't have to waste time on things like hydrochloroquine, ultraviolet light and bleach.
And I'll tell you an even more important point. So the CDC, as we were on public stay-at-home order still in April, the CDC put out very clear step-by-step gated guidance of how the states should think about opening up, what was phase one, what the testing should look like, what contact tracing needed to be, what hospital capacity needed to be, how you measure that. The following day, the president blew that guidance apart by going after three blue state governors and saying, immediately liberate Michigan, liberate Virginia. That was enormously dangerous. And so we've never had clear guidance that was able to be put out that everybody said, I can accept this. Here's what we're going to try to do. We've never had the kind of communication and trust building that we need. Mm.
Well, Angie Rasmussen, Ali Khan and Michael Mina, thanks for listening to Secretary Sebelius get her first crack at this. But really, task force, just jump in. How would you respond to what she said? What do you guys want to talk about with each other? I'm going to let you go for it.
You probably found the perfect person, Secretary Sebelius, and she'll always be Secretary Sebelius to me, who can sort of bridge across the governors and bridge across what needs to happen at HHS. I think part of this, and the secretary alluded to this, is in the conversation with the governors, the vice president, President-elect Biden and his team needs to resolve this dichotomy that has driven a wedge. Yes, it has been politicized, but part of this wedge has been an economic wedge with a false dichotomy that either we take care of the economy or we take care of the virus. And I think good science can help prove that if you take care of the virus, you do take care of the economy and revive the economy. China is the only major country that is going to have an increased GDP this year, and they did it because they took care of the virus. And I think that will drive a lot of actions. Leadership is part one of the control triad, and getting the governors to say the exact same thing as the new administrative team and everybody up and down the line is going to help. And I'm going to go a little past. The secretary's obviously a lot more articulate than I would ever be about this and reserve. But this is the greatest public health disaster in our nation's history. I mean, we have at least 300,000 people who do not need to be dead, who are dead now. And it's because we have adopted a herd immunity, infect everybody strategy, and never took a appropriate containment plan for America that would have put us in the place of so many other countries with markedly less deaths.
So I think that something that we can do today is really to start working on what are the concrete steps that we need to take. And I think this has been enormously interesting, I think, to talk about communication, and that's obvious. That's going to be priority number one. But the steps that we need to take that are actually concrete, I think what we can do now is to start shifting and start to ask, what have we been trying and why hasn't it been working? And are there new avenues, total new approaches? Can we change the paradigm of how we are dealing with this pandemic that may be distinct from what the textbooks would say is the right way to deal with a pandemic like this? Because we have a unique situation in the United States where people are not behaving for many reasons, largely, I think, because of the current administration. People are not behaving in a way that's commensurate with normal behavior that you'd expect during a pandemic time. And so one plan, if you will, that I think could actually work is to change from a more paternalistic public health approach, which is sort of reporting and contact tracing and trying to push a lot of sort of top-down testing on people, for example, and try to put the public back in public health and get tests to people for them to use on their own terms and as frequently as they would like. Put tests in everyone's home in America or half of the homes in America so that people can know their status and make behavioral modifications as a result of that. And I think that if we start really pushing new approaches that might give people a little bit more empowerment, and especially people who don't like Big Brother, if you will, looking over them, which is unfortunately a large fraction of our country where cases are greatest, we can start to shift a dynamic a bit to really give people control over their decision making.
Michael Mina, I was wondering how long it would take for you to get to this.
I need to add rapid testing
in everyone's home. Ali Khan, you're not a fan.
No, I'm not a fan because we've not yet taken the strategies that we know work and have worked in Australia, which is not, China, have worked in New Zealand, has worked in Taiwan. We have not used those strategies yet in the United States. Nobody on this call can tell me how many people in the U.S. are isolated, how many days it takes to isolation in the U.S. Nobody on this call can tell me how many people are quarantined in the United States, how long did it take us to quarantine them, what proportion of contacts were ever quarantined. Nobody on this call can tell me how many of our new cases are coming from a quarantine list. I mean, this is stuff that CDC has been teaching other countries how to do for decades that we are unable to do in our own country. And we know we can do this, right? We do it for TB. We do it for measles. We know how to do this. We have not used the existing public health tools. And yes, I will agree with Michael that once we exhaust the existing public health tools, there's rule that, we can use other tools if we want to. But tests are useless if you don't act on a test. And that's what's happening right now.
Yeah, and Ali, I would love to jump in if I could for just a minute. I kind of agree with both of you because I don't think it's an either or. I am not in the science world as the three of you are. So I deal with, folks in my neighborhood. I'm in a state, Kansas, where the virus is spiraling. I can guarantee you that nobody understands the contact tracing protocol and nobody is following it because people have essentially not communicated clearly enough what the steps are. What happens if you're called by a colleague and said, I just got tested and I'm positive? What is it that you are supposed to do? It's very confusing. And I think that needs to be very clearly articulated over and over and over. What does quarantine mean? What does isolation mean? What's your responsibility? What should your family be doing? It's almost like we've given up on contact tracing. And in many parts of the country, the message is the virus is out of control and there's no way to get a handle on it. So we're just not going to do that. And I think that's very, very dangerous. And we need to start there. But I also agree that having the capacity to ramp up testing, and again, back to the president-elect Biden, who has said this is a piece of the puzzle, and giving people the opportunity to make risk-based decisions on their own with the comfort, if you will, of having a rapid test available. I haven't seen grandchildren in 8 months. I would love to be able to know that I could have a visit and be sure that they are safe and I am safe. But part of that may be the availability of rapid tests for everybody, that we can test before, test after, monitor ourselves, be willing to follow the protocol. But things like that, I think, could be game changers. One is people need to...
Secretary Sebelius, I'm so sorry to jump in on you, because one thing a real task force doesn't have to deal with are breaks for a radio program. But we have to just honor that part of this reality, being a radio show. So Kathleen Sebelius, Michael Mina, Ali Khan, and Angie Rasmussen, they are our informal COVID-19 task force joining us on the program today. Lots more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. President-elect Joe Biden named his COVID-19 transition task force on Monday. And today, here on this program, we have convened our own informal task force, bringing back together some of the brightest minds in public health that we have spoken to over the course of this pandemic. Angie Rasmussen joins us. She's a virologist at Columbia University. Ali Khan is with us. He's dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Nebraska, formerly director of the CDC's Office of Public Health Preparedness and Response. Michael Mina is with us. He's an assistant professor of epidemiology, immunology, and infectious diseases at Harvard. And Kathleen Sebelius is with us as well, former Secretary of Health and Human Services in the Obama administration, former governor of Kansas. And Secretary Sebelius, because we had to take the break there, I had to interrupt you in mid-thought, and I just wanted to give you a chance to finish that thought before we move on to some other aspects of priorities that the Biden administration should focus on.
Well, thanks, Meghna. I really was pretty well finished. Okay. I think we need to understand contact tracing at a personal level. That needs to be very clearly articulated, and to the points that Michael was making earlier, individual responsibility really starts there. What is my role in that? How do I act? What am I supposed to do? Because that's very, very unclear, I think, across the country. And secondly, getting rapid tests into people's hands, I think, would be also very helpful so people can make their own decisions on a more thoughtful basis.
Got it. So, Angie and Michael, I'm going to turn back to you before we leave slightly contentious question about rapid testing behind. Angie, I just wanted to hear from you on your thinking about Michael Mina's suggestion to really sort of revolutionize the public health paradigm around this.
Yeah, so like Secretary Sebelius, I'm somewhat in the middle on this issue. I think that the point that Michael makes about empowering people to really take their health into their own hands is a really good one. And I think, again, you know, one of the biggest problems what Secretary Sebelius was saying is that people have not known what to actually do. If they think that they have COVID, if they get a positive test, even, you know, from their provider, I think that the lack of clear guidance and clear instructions, actionable information, has really, really been harmful. But that said, I also agree with Ali that we do need to be taking care of this. We need to understand exactly how prevalence is in the community, and rapid testing doesn't have the same rigor in terms of reporting that tests, you know, when you go to your doctor and they have to report it to the local health department. So we need to find a balance between allowing people to really take control of their own health, put it in their own hands, and make sure that the appropriate data is being reported to public health authorities to inform strategy and guidance moving forward.
We're already doing more tests in any other country. We're already doing it, Mike. I'll give it back to you then. We're already doing more tests than almost any other country in the world. And yes, I can support absolutely, as Michael says, and as the secretary says, that having even more tests available would be helpful as long as people understand the tests. But really, to me, it's about taking action on those tests and getting cases down in the community will require us to support the science, support CDC, support our local health departments to act on the tests that they're already doing for contact tracing and isolation. And that's what's going to get this disease down in our country. Back to you, Michael.
Thanks. So I want to be very, very clear that these are not distinct entities. There are ways to put the tests into people's hands. These are two different types of tests, first of all. One is surveillance testing with tracing and isolation as a follow-up to that surveillance testing. And that's currently what we're doing. This is a whole additional type of test, which is public health screening. And it doesn't mean don't do contact tracing, but it means there are a lot of people who don't want to be tested with government oversight. And there are a lot of people who don't want to go to a drive-through and get a PCR test. They just won't do it. They don't have time and many other reasons. But you can work with Apple and Google and Verizon and AT&T and all these mega companies and make reporting your result voluntary and as easy as ordering something on Amazon. Mm. If I can get a microwave to my front door tomorrow, I can report a result. Using a mobile app or a computer. So we can actually build much, much more reporting than we would otherwise get through our current structure if we get just a fraction of people to report from a much larger pool of tests being performed.
Okay, so there's one thing I just want to follow up on that, and then I want to move to also some more concrete, using what you yes. pointed out, Mike, like concrete things we can do. But Michael, you just mentioned basically harnessing the resources of the entire country. That's what you're saying. Not just the government, but, so Secretary Sebelius, let me turn to you. Should the president-elect and his task force and his transition team be going to Amazon, be going to, like Michael said, Apple, Facebook, Google, and saying, you guys have enormous resources. You reach into every home in the United States. Can we somehow work together to bring in these resources to be part of an overall pandemic response?
Absolutely. They should do that. It should be a public-private enterprise. I think that, again, President-elect Biden has already made it clear he wants to mobilize all the resources available, everything from using the Defense Production Act to ramp up protective equipment. And we are about to run into shortages once again, which is really terrifying to healthcare workers and folks in nursing homes. We should use the technology platforms. And a lot of these companies were trying to do things on their own, but a coordinated government response and kind of a blessing saying, here are the kinds of things. I think employers would love to have a way to use technology platforms to make sure their workers coming in and out of offices are safe, make sure that people in factory lines are safe. But all of that needs, I think, some kind of coordinated vetting kind of umbrella where the federal government takes a lead and calls on the resources across the country. Michael talked about a warlike approach, and I think that's exactly what we need here but it has to be led by the government who has unique muscle. They have logistics support. They have the communication from the bully pulpit to the White House. They have the opportunity to work with state and local leaders who are elected. They have the ability to call on our private sector leaders. And so there isn't anybody like the federal government to take that leadership role.
Well, we're getting a lot of response online to this illustrious task force that we have convened. For example, D.R. Shervish says Trump has vilified contact tracing and politicized it as government overreach. How do you walk that back with all the people who are now anti-science? Someone calling themselves Black Hills Bumbles says, I live in South Dakota, blocks away from the governor's mansion. Governor Noem believes in what she's saying. She believes in freedom over common sense. It won't go away with Biden. We need federal help here. We are suffering. Okay, so that's just a little taste of a lot of the feedback we're getting online here. We've just got about 8 minutes left, and there's a couple other of the many important things we could discuss. So let us talk about another concrete step, and that is a vaccine. So here is the current Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar. He was on NBC's Today just yesterday, outlining the time frame of when the country can expect the Pfizer vaccine to be available.
Pfizer will be producing and delivering to us approximately 20 million doses of vaccine each month, starting at the end of this month in November. Moderna is also producing. We have anticipated that we will have enough vaccine by the end of December to have vaccinated our most vulnerable citizens in nursing homes and otherwise, and by the end of January, enough for all healthcare workers and first responders, and enough for all Americans by the end of March to early April to have general vaccination programs.
That's the current Secretary of HHS, Alex Azar. Now, Pfizer, of course, made that announcement on Monday that early data shows that their vaccine might be 90% effective. But Angie, I'm going to open this up again to all four of you. But Angie, let me just start with you. First of all, double fact check me on something. Pfizer's vaccine has not yet been FDA approved, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So does the timeline that the Secretary is talking about there sound reasonable? And then tell us more about what you would advise the task force on about vaccination.
So I think that timeline is extremely optimistic, to say the least. Specifically with the Pfizer vaccine, there are pretty stringent cold chain requirements for distributing that vaccine. So it's going to be a challenge to distribute. I think 20 million doses does not cover the entire population of the most vulnerable Americans, not by a long shot. That partly depends on your definition of vulnerable. But if that's going to be vaccinating both healthcare workers as well as people who have higher risk of getting severe COVID, I think that that is really unrealistic. I'm also not clear over whether those 20 million doses that Secretary Azar mentioned refer to individual doses. This is a two-dose vaccine regimen. So that means that if that's referring to individual doses, that's actually only 10 million doses, and that's completely inadequate. I think it's also very unrealistic to suggest that that this vaccine will even be approved. We don't know all of that yet. This was a very encouraging interim data analysis that was performed, but it's not FDA approval. It's not the issuing of an emergency use authorization that would allow that vaccine to be distributed. So I think one of the things that the Biden task force is going to have to reckon with is both the supply of vaccines as well as how to not only distribute the vaccines, but to make sure that they're being distributed equitably. And also, finally, to overcome the real challenge of vaccine hesitancy. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people who are normally not vaccine hesitant are going to be hesitant to take this vaccine because the Trump administration has named it Operation Warp Speed. And there, you know, there's all this talk about this accelerated vaccine development and testing pipeline. I think a lot of people are skeptical that these vaccines have been tested as thoroughly as they need to be to ensure that they're safe and effective. So there's going to be some real challenges in winning hearts and minds to the cause of even getting vaccinated. I think that saying that everybody's going to have access to a vaccine by March and April is optimistic to the point of being unrealistic.
Yeah. Floor is open to the rest of you.
When it comes to evaluating vaccines and the immune response to them, there are two major pieces that we still don't know. Pfizer's news was extraordinarily encouraging, But we have to take it with a major grain of salt to a certain extent, or caution at least, which is we don't know how well it will work in the most vulnerable people who we really want it to work in. That is not, we haven't done the stratified analysis. It's a limited number of people who are really, we saw the protection in relative to the control group. So we need to get better data on how well it will work in elderly people. Their immune systems don't work the way that somebody who's younger and more robust works. The other bit is we don't know how well they will stop transmission, and that underlies this whole idea of vaccine-mediated herd immunity. And we have to better understand that, but we have no data on it. And finally, the last point is these are early results from a vaccine trial. Mm-hmm. Early after somebody gets a vaccine, their body makes a huge number of antibodies that ultimately have to, by definition, wane very rapidly. They come from a different type of cell than long-term immunity. So we really have to be cautious in interpreting these early results with compared to what might be at, say, the 6 to 12 month time point after people get vaccinated. And so there's a lot of unknowns despite these first encouraging results.
I always start any vaccine question off with a reminder that multiple countries in this world using existing public health tools have gotten to zero cases without a vaccine. And we have the globe's premier public health agency, CDC. If we use their guidance and their science, we could do that here in the U.S. That said, vaccine will be a wonderful addition to the existing tools that exist to get us to a containment strategy and get cases down in the U.S. I think Michael and Angie hit it right on the head in terms of trust. So I'd say we need more than a safe and efficacious vaccine. We needed a trusted vaccine. And the trusted vaccine means that once the data comes in from the company, FDA needs to be duly diligent to go through all of their regulatory requirements and external advisory board review, including the ACIP, which is the CDC's mechanism for immunization practices, so that the American people can be assured that the vaccine that's being delivered to them is safe, efficacious, and can be trusted.
And Meghna, I would agree with all of my colleagues. Cautionary notes on the timeline. Certainly, this is early data that is encouraging, but a long way from the finish line. We need to know about vulnerable populations. We need to do a lot in the meantime. But I would just mention two pieces of this vaccination puzzle, which I think are huge for the United States beyond what my colleagues have talked about. One is just the logistics of getting a cold chain vaccine to the right places at the right time. This will require extraordinary collaboration with governors and local leaders, with the plan to transport in a timely fashion to areas that need vaccination. What I've been told by our governor was that states have been told so far that, once this is available, it will come in major pallets to a one location and it's up to the state. Again, I think a big problem. So having a national strategy for logistics, which again, President-elect Biden has pledged to do and I think is hard at work doing, is really important. Where is the vaccine going to be? How do people get it? Who's going to do the vaccination? How does that all work? How transparent is it? How do you determine state by state who the most vulnerable people are and where they are is a piece of the puzzle. The other piece of the puzzle that we really haven't talked about is the United States has walked away from all of the global discussions on vaccine. We are not part of the funding for equitable vaccine distribution worldwide. We have threatened to withdraw from the WHO. We are dealing with a worldwide pandemic, and the most dangerous place for the U.S. to be is in a U.S.-centric situation where we are going to vaccinate everybody we can in the U.S. and ignore everyone in the world, because that will just make sure that the first plane load coming from anywhere is likely to bring the virus right back to this country. So we have to immediately re-engage with our international partners. Mm. We have to look at equitable distribution, not only in the U.S., but worldwide.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We have run out of time for this convening of our informal COVID-19 task force. We're going to do it again. But for now, Kathleen Sebelius, Michael Mina, Ali Khan, and Angie Rasmussen, thank you to all four of you for helping us get our minds started down the road on how to turn things around. We'll do it again. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.